Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Carl Canetta of the Project on Defense Alternatives, who assesses the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan and the failure of Washington to address the political and economic conditions that produce support for the Taliban. Deborah James of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the reasons behind the recent collapse of World Trade Organization talks in Geneva. And Michael Stoops of the National Coalition for the Homeless, who questions the reliability of government estimates that maintain the number of homeless people across the U.S. has declined. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Pepsi's new Olympic ad campaign, the junk food giant boasts of going red for China. The company is turning its trademark blue can to red for the Beijing Olympics. Pepsi is only one of many Western companies ready to spend $6 billion on Olympic advertising in the largely untapped Chinese market of more than a billion people. According to The Nation magazine, Olympic corporate sponsors such as Coke, General Electric, UPS, McDonald's, and Kodak hope to make a lasting impact on the loyalty of Chinese consumers. The high-profile corporate sponsors have run into stinging criticism from human rights activists for remaining quiet on hot-button issues like the occupation of Tibet and war crimes in Darfur. Chinese officials have continued to censor the internet and clamp down on dissent. In a move to soften up relations with Beijing before the Olympics, the U.S. State Department took China off the list of nations violating human rights. Meanwhile, Beijing has spent $40 billion on new stadiums and transit links for the Games. In the process, the government has displaced 1.5 million people. 200 Olympic athletes involved with Team Darfur are planning to wear protest wristbands and speak out about human rights. Longtime Alaska Republican Senator Ted Stevens was indicted in late July on 7 felony counts by a federal court for failing to disclose gifts from the Veeco Corporation, a major oil service company. Veeco has been at the center of a major corruption scandal in Alaska that involves Stevens and his son Ben, the former president of the state senate and now a lobbyist for the fishing industry. Among the $250,000 in gifts that Ted Stevens failed to disclose from 1990 to 2000 were major renovations to his Alaska home, a Land Rover vehicle, and a Viking gas grill. These type of gifts would be outlawed in a bill now stalled in the U.S. Senate, dubbed the Public Corruption Prosecutions Improvement Act. The anti-corruption bill is sponsored by Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont and GOP Senator John Cornyn of Texas. The measure would ban legislators from accepting gifts, such as Super Bowl tickets, above a set limit defined by the Senate. The bill, as written, would also ban special mortgage discounts that several senators and Bush administration officials received from subprime lenders like Countrywide Financial. According to the Los Angeles Times, the bill is bottled up due to the opposition of Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, the ranking Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Specter says the bill gives federal prosecutors too much power. Montana federal judge Donald Malloy has reinstated protections for the gray wolf population in the Northern Rockies, a major victory for environmentalists. The court's injunction reversed a move by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to take gray wolves off the endangered species list due to increased numbers in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. The wolves were nearly driven into extinction in the 1930s. The 40-page judicial order scolded officials from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, saying the agency provided no new evidence or research to support the policy change. Judge Malloy added, Congress did not intend agency decision-making to be fickle. Since the Wildlife Service delisted the gray wolves in March, over 100 wolves have been killed. In addition, the states of Montana, Wyoming, and Idaho had scheduled wolf hunts for the fall, now canceled by the injunction. In the mid-1990s, federal wildlife officials reintroduced 66 gray wolves into central Idaho and Yellowstone National Park to create a stable population. The number of gray wolves living in the Northern Rockies now exceeds 1,500. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Bill Cosentino.
As violence against U.S. occupation forces continues to decline in Iraq, the situation in America's forgotten war in Afghanistan has markedly deteriorated. 16 U.S. troops were killed in Afghanistan during July, while 10 were killed in Iraq during the same period. This turnabout underscores the success of the Taliban insurgency's aggressive new tactics, and the resilience of the group, which had formerly governed Afghanistan from 1996 up until the post-9/11 U.S. invasion in October 2001. Even as the three major U.S. TV networks have cut back on their coverage of the Afghanistan conflict, there has been an increase in the number and sophistication of Taliban attacks against Afghan and NATO troops. In June, the Taliban mounted a dramatic attack on Sarposa prison in Kandahar City, which freed some 800 prisoners, half of them supporters of the insurgents. But as U.S. and NATO forces react to increased Taliban activity with more airstrikes and raids on villages, a greater number of civilians are being killed and injured. This has resulted in rising anger among the population against foreign troops and protests against what many Afghans believe are indiscriminate attacks and a failure to prevent harm to civilians. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Carl Canetta, co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives, who assesses the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan and the failure of Washington to address the political and economic conditions that produce support for the Taliban.
Well, I think generally speaking, the situation in Afghanistan has grown steadily worse over the past 30 months especially. Overall, we see a resurgence of Taliban strength. The Taliban is rooted in Afghanistan, but it also has safe havens in the border areas of Pakistan. Our efforts there have been focused on chasing down those we think are the evil ones, the bad guys, the terrorists, making no distinction between Taliban and Al-Qaeda. But there's been little emphasis on economic development, certainly insufficient emphasis in the south, where much of the problem resides. And people turned in two directions, one toward opium production and the other toward the Taliban. As we try to eradicate opium, people turn even more to the Taliban. So what we find today is a resurgent movement, although there has been some progress in the economic realm in Afghanistan. Not much of it has trickled down to people, especially in the south where it is most needed. We have a lot of soldiers there. We don't have many agricultural experts. A lot of promises were made about money and development aid coming there. Those promises fell short. The amounts of money we're talking about, which are not insignificant, about $15 billion over 8 years, pale in comparison to the amount of money spent on the military. We've spent, the United States, and there are other countries involved as well, but we've spent about $170 billion, so more than 10 times as much military money than development money. And now, in a sense, we're facing the consequences.
Carl, I wanted to ask you about the economic conditions in particular that attract recruits to the Taliban insurgency. What is it that the U.S. Should be doing that they're not doing currently that could weaken the Taliban's hold on the people of Afghanistan, given that their rule when they were in power from 1996 to 2001 was quite harsh, intolerant, and I think viewed by much of the world as a very undesirable political regime.
We are giving them aid that is not sustainable. We go in and we do what seems to be the technically proper thing to do without having enough appreciation for both the physical and the political conditions in the country. And we don't employ enough Afghanis. So there's a number of things that need to be done, but I would say if there's a sweeping one large lesson, it's that the emphasis on military instruments and on the military task to the detriment of the political and the economic tasks, that's a mistake.
Well, Carl, just one last question if I could, and that is more than one world power has been booted out of Afghanistan, the British, the Russians with help from Washington, and now the United States is deep into Afghanistan with a big fight on their hands. Do you think this is going to be a multi-year quagmire for the United States, and how to avoid that?
Well, I think we're on that road, unfortunately, and I don't think that some of the talk about increasing our military presence there is really that smart. It's become something of a political football. Take the troops out of Iraq and put them in Afghanistan, and it probably the reason that might seem appealing to many people is well, you pointed out earlier that there's been little attention paid to Afghanistan, but in fact, we have been steadily increasing our forces there. In 2004, at the beginning of 2004, I think we had between us and the presence of the Europeans, there's something in the vicinity of 17,000 or 18,000 troops there. Today, the combined forces are more in the range of 66,000. And rather than seeing security improve and development improve, while the force levels went up, we saw them deteriorate. So the correlation between the two is not that encouraging. And I think that if we continue to emphasize the military approach to the detriment of the economic and the political, sure, we will find ourselves there for a long time. Because the modernization of that country and reconciliation within that country, and the same goes for Iraq, is not a job of 2 or 3 years. It's a job of 2 or 3 decades. And the question is the method that we're going to rely on, is it going to be principally a military one? Is it going to be one that sees our approach requiring a troop presence, an enormous troop presence in those countries? I don't think that's the best path. I don't think it's sustainable. I think it has a lot of negative consequences, a lot of inadvertent consequences. We go in there, and we become part of the problem, which is what we see in both countries. So we really need to think this through and not allow it to become a political football, and not simply assume that moving you know, 2 or 3 brigades from Iraq over to Afghanistan is the way to improve the situation in Afghanistan.
That was Carl Canetta, co-director of the Project on Defense Alternatives. Contact the project at area code 617-547-4474 or visit their website at comw.org/PDA. Governments of many developing nations around the world came away from the recent collapse of World Trade Organization talks in Geneva convinced that no deal was better than a bad deal. The talks ended without agreement on July 29th, with the biggest stumbling block being rising food prices and many nations' desire to implement policies to ensure food security. The U.S. and European nations failed to convince India, China, and some 100 smaller developing nations to cut food import tariffs and domestic subsidies supporting local farmers. The talks, known as the Doha Development Round, began in 2001 after the collapse of WTO negotiations in Seattle amid militant trade union and environmentalist protests there in 1999. A similar breakdown in talks occurred in Cancun, Mexico in 2003. Developing countries have resisted opening up their markets based on concerns that without domestic protections, giant agribusinesses from the U.S. and Europe would be able to dump cheap food into local markets, decimating local farmers and triggering the loss of millions of jobs. One of the other factors in the collapse of WTO talks was the lame duck status of President Bush, who has less than 6 months left in office and opposition to some free trade policies by Democrats in the U.S. Congress. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Deborah James, Director of International Programs at the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who examines the reasons behind the collapse of WTO talks and the likely next chapter in global trade negotiations.
Well, your listeners probably remember that many of us fought against a launch of an expansion of the WTO round in 1999 in Seattle. And after that didn't happen, then the WTO had to go to Doha, Qatar, to launch a round in a country where civil society is not allowed to protest. And they did that just right after the September 11th attacks in 2001. They had another ministerial meeting in 2003 in Cancun, Mexico, that ended in a spectacular failure amidst protests of about 50,000 farmers. And then another ministerial in Hong Kong in 2005 that sort of limped along. I mean, it papered over the major differences, but they didn't call it a collapse. This meeting was actually a mini-ministerial And it was because they didn't actually have a ministerial last year like they should have. And at this point, Lamy was just trying to sort of ram through a conclusion to the expansion round before George Bush leaves office. And because, you know, they have to have sort of a major political agreement on the framework, or what they call the modalities of the agreement, it takes them about 6 months after that to finish all the details. This was the last chance to do that before Bush left. And because they failed to do so, they failed to come to an agreement on some of these key issues, it's going to be another year or two before they can really have another conclusion. Of course, they'll continue with technical negotiations because WTO negotiators have job security, but they will really not be able to pursue an agreement. And that gives us a tremendous window to say, hey, you know, the problem here is that it was really the wrong model. This is not the kind of trade that we want to have, and start to push in a new direction.
Deborah, who would you say are the big winners and losers here with the collapse of the talks?
Well, I would say that the winners are certainly the farmers and workers around the world that are not going to be subjected to more of this terrible trade model that has wreaked such havoc across the globe. If we look at, you know, just taking the last 13 years of the WTO's existence, or even just more generally the last 30 years, where this sort of neoliberal policy package has been implemented both in developed and developing countries around the world, you look at some of the results of that. I mean, Africa has gone backwards in terms of economic growth over the last 30 years. The majority of Latin American countries from 1980 to 2005 were in an almost economic stagnation. They had only one-half of 1% of economic growth during that time. Certainly in the United States, we've had economic growth, but wages have been stagnant at levels of, from 1973 for quite a while. We've lost 3 million manufacturing jobs just in the last 5 or 10 years. So, you know, the implications of this model have been negative, I think, for workers and farmers and the environment and women and just lots of different populations. Of course, it's been good for the corporations that are the ones who have been writing these rules. But I think in terms of the specific lack of ability of them to come to an agreement, there are specific issues, obviously, over tariffs on goods and agriculture that cause the stalemate. But it really is a bigger sign to say, you know, none of these countries want this. If any country is negotiating really based on its base, its actual constituents, its citizens, they're not going to go for a deal because the model is the wrong deal. It's not just that you can't get countries to agree to something. It's that the whole framework of what they're looking at is the wrong framework.
Deborah, I wanted to ask you, what happens next with the World Trade Organization? Where do they go now? Where do they try to go?
Well, the WTO still exists, so everyone should realize that the WTO is an institution. It's not a trade agreement that passes or doesn't get passed. It is an institution that was approved and went into existence in 1995, so we're kind of stuck with it at this point. There will be an increase in the judicial aspect of the WTO as a world government, so there will be increased cases and filings and things like that in WTO, as they haven't been able to find solutions to the issues that many countries have had with U.S. subsidies and other things through the negotiations. They will continue negotiations. They have already started talking about, you know, picking up the pieces in September, but they won't be able to conclude a deal, really, even to try to have another ministerial-level meeting. And ministerial-level just means that they bring in sort of the political big dogs to make the hard decisions. They won't be able to do that for quite a while again. But I think it does give us the opportunity to really call for an assessment. If we as people around the world say we need to call for, you know, take advantage of this collapse, call for an assessment of the impact of WTO, has it actually achieved its goal of increasing economic prosperity worldwide? I think it's pretty obvious that it hasn't. And then we can move towards saying, let's actually talk about dismantling this institution and moving towards a different set of multilateral rules and get some of those ideas on the table. Because until people start thinking about the fact that there doesn't have to be just one way to develop a global economy, people like us still get accused of being anti-globalization. When we're not, obviously we like interconnectedness between different parts of the globe. We like, you know, all the different benefits that globalization has brought. We just want to make sure it's the right path and the right model.
That was Deborah James, Director of International Programs at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. Contact the center at area code 202-293-5380 or visit their website at cepr.net. According to a Bush administration report announced in late July, the number of chronically homeless people living on the nation's streets and in shelters has dropped by about 30%, from about 176,000 to 124,000 from 2005 to 2007. Chronically homeless people make up 18% of the total number of homeless in the U.S. Officials at HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, said the drop is largely due to implementation of its Housing First policy, in which hard-to-house individuals are placed in permanent shelter, apartments, halfway houses, or rooms, and provided services for drug addiction, mental illness, and health problems. Some housing advocates hail the reduction, but others are skeptical that more of the chronically homeless have, in fact, escaped homelessness. Many are also concerned about individuals and families who may be homeless for shorter periods of time or are not counted as homeless at all. Nationally, the government estimates the total number of homeless people in the U.S. has dropped to about 666,000 in 2007 from 754,000 in 2005. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Michael Stoops, acting executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. He addresses different definitions of homelessness that are used by the federal government and by advocacy groups, and predicts a coming wave of homelessness due to the home mortgage crisis.
We are glad that whenever there's a decrease in the homeless population, if the figures are true, we hope that the folks who are no longer seeking help have gotten help and are now housed individuals. However, the overall decrease in numbers, they're only counting the folks that go to shelters and seek out services, and it's not counting the folks who've given up either on themselves or on society, and that's nearly half of the homeless population. So we think that the count is probably not accurate. The decrease in the chronic homeless population, and the chronic means that people have been on the streets for a while. Some of those folks have been able to get into a limited number of housing vouchers designed specifically for the hard-to-serve homeless population. But in many cases, the chronic homeless folks have been pushed out of the downtown areas as downtown America has become more gentrified. And those folks they're no longer visible, and therefore they're no longer being counted. So sometimes cities will say, well, we don't have a problem anymore because we don't see any homeless people.
Who exactly is considered homeless?
The federal government has a very narrow definition of who the homeless are. You have to either be in a shelter or on the streets, and the majority of homeless people sometimes are sleeping in their cars or doubled and tripled up, living with family or friends, or they're renting a cheap motel on a week-to-week basis.
And none of them are counted?
And none of them are considered part of the homeless population, even though we consider them to be homeless, and therefore they're not eligible for whatever government programs are available for homeless individuals. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development requires communities to do a point-in-time count for 24 hours during the last week of January. A study that they put out in 2007, and it was for 2005, in which they found that 44% of the nation's homeless were unsheltered, and that was a staggering figure.
Michael Stoops, can you explain what the Federal Housing and Urban Development's Housing First policy means for the chronically homeless?
The so-called Housing First program, where people get housing vouchers for the folks who are the chronic. Here in Washington, D.C., last year, we have 12,000 homeless people on any given night. We have about 4,000 shelter beds, more during the winter than during the summer. And so they only had 25 Housing First vouchers available. So how do they decide who are the lucky few? They did a lottery system, and my friend David, who's a paranoid schizophrenic, he lucked out. And he's now into housing because he won the lottery. So we need to make sure that everybody is getting help. And our federal government, they're fixated with just trying to end chronic homelessness. And we want to end homelessness for everybody, including families and children, single men, etc. To be honest, we've all grown accustomed to having homeless people living on our streets and sidewalks and parks, and we walk by people who are living outside. So when people say that we've solved the problem, we still have a long ways to go.
So what's your best guess about whether homelessness is increasing or decreasing?
The recent report where the government is saying the numbers are down, many cities around the country are saying the complete opposite, that there's been an increase in the numbers. Our network of shelters and soup kitchens and food pantries are telling us that there's no room at the inn. The food cupboard is empty. The soup line is a lot longer. And this is even before the impact of the current unofficial recession that everybody knows that we're currently in, and it doesn't include the thousands of people nationwide, tens of thousands, who have lost their homes due to foreclosures. Both homeowners and tenants have lost their homes, and those folks will not become homeless right away overnight. It could be a year to 2 years before they literally come knocking on our shelter door. So there's a tidal wave coming, a bad tidal wave, and we hope that the new Congress and the new president will make ending poverty in this country a priority. Right now, our government is only spending $1.5 billion a year to help homeless people nationwide. You could spend that amount in one state, and there would still be people living on the streets. So it's clear we need additional resources, and I don't care whether it comes from Bill Gates or the federal government. It must be done.
That was Michael Stoops of the National Coalition for the Homeless based in Washington, D.C. Contact the coalition at area code 202-462-4822 or visit their website at nationalhomeless.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.